I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we want to bring you into one of the most important conversations we are having in this country. It's about our schools. Welcome to our Twitter Education Forum. Today, we are broadcasting from member station WLRN in Miami, but the conversation has actually already started. For the past month on Twitter, using the hashtag NPREdChat, we've already been hearing from our radio audience and from our digital audience.
Technology in education is so important, but the most innovative tool is a child's mind. How do we help students to integrate all that they learn?
That is scientist and educator Nancy Evans, and she is reading just one of the hundreds of tweets that we have already received from around the country. And in fact, many of the issues you raised have helped shape today's Twitter Education Forum. We're going to pose as many of these questions as we can to our guests, so please continue to submit your comments using hashtag NPREdChat. And we are going to begin today with two newsmaker interviews. In a few minutes, we'll hear from the former Education Secretary Margaret Spellings, who served in the administration of George W. Bush. But first, current Secretary of Education, appointed by President Barack Obama, Arne Duncan. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Secretary. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
The question we asked to get our listeners started in the conversation was, are America's schools broken? So I'm going to ask you that question.
We have many schools that are extraordinarily high-performing, so I think that's an overly harsh statement. Having said that, Michelle, we have a long way to go. And when I look at a 25% dropout rate, a million children leaving our schools for our streets each year, when I look at the percentage of high school graduates that are having to take remedial classes in college, they're not really prepared. And then when I ultimately look at a college graduation rate where the United States is 14th in the world, used to be number one a generation ago, we have a lot of hard work ahead of us.
Now, we didn't just hear complaints from listeners, as you might imagine. We heard a lot of people who had some specific and constructive ideas for what they think the solutions are. I just want to play a tweet that we got from Rowena Lee. She's a recent college graduate in Grand Island, Nebraska. Here it is.
Money needs to be redirected to education. There are too many unqualified teachers, and unfortunately, the highly educated often won't go into teaching because they can work in much higher paying industries.
True or not, Mr. Secretary? Should it be a priority of this administration or the next to make teaching a more attractive career option?
Absolutely. First of all, education is the best investment we can make. Others see education as an expense and something that we can cut. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. But we absolutely have to elevate and strengthen the teaching profession. We've launched what we call the Respect Project, which is actually being led by classroom teachers around the country. Our teacher ambassador fellows have done hundreds of roundtables, and we want to attract and retain the next generation of talent. How we recruit that talent, how we keep that talent in the profession for the long haul is going to shape public education for the next 30 years.
You know, many people, of course, appreciate the administration's focus on education, but you do have your critics, as of course you know, and that criticism is very similar to the criticism that people had of the prior administration's education initiative. Yours is called Race to the Top. Theirs was called No Child Left Behind. But the core of the criticism of both is that it's just too much emphasis on testing and that it puts too much pressure on teachers and doesn't account for another factors in other kids' lives, like poverty, for example. And how do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, no one should have to teach the test. Where we differ tremendously from No Child Left Behind, as I agree, I think there was far too much emphasis on one test and getting students to a proficiency cut score than in many states actually got dummied down. So I think No Child Left Behind is fundamentally broken. We wanted Congress to fix it. Unfortunately, Congress has been pretty broken. So we've been able to provide flexibility, provide waivers to about 33 states with another 10 or so that we're looking at to allow them to build much more thoughtful accountability systems, looking at growth and gain rather than absolute test score. But looking, Michelle, our high school graduation rates going up, our dropout rates going down. And so through the waiver process, you're seeing, I think, a huge move away from a focus just on a test score to long-term indicators. And I always say, if you have the best third grade test scores in the world, but you have a 50% dropout rate, you're not changing your students' lives.
Last week, you tweeted this. If we are serious about closing the achievement gap, we have to get serious about closing the opportunity gap. And as a country, we're not even close. Now, that was retweeted more than 200 times. So obviously, that's something that a lot of people are thinking about. But what does that actually mean? And what does it What is the single most important thing you think the country needs to do to get there?
Well, there's a lot there, and there aren't simple answers to this. These are complex questions and issues. But, Michelle, that's something I believe passionately. And if we are serious about closing the achievement gap, we have to stop admiring the problem, and we have to close what I call the opportunity gap. So my question is, Michelle, in how many communities, be it inner city, urban, or rural, or remote, are we systemically identifying the hardest working, the most committed teachers and principals, and putting them in the schools where the children need the most support? In how many of those communities are we making sure that children have access to a great school 10, 11, 12 hours a day, 6, 7 days a week, with a rich array of after-school programming, programs for parents, GED, ESL, family literacy nights? What are we doing around technology to make sure those children, those communities have access to learning 24/7? And quite frankly, Michelle, I don't think we've been serious enough as a country in closing the opportunity gap. And I'm going to continue to push very, very hard to do that.
Arne Duncan is the Secretary of Education, and he was kind enough to join us from our studios in Washington, D.C. Thanks again, Mr. Secretary.
Thanks. Take care now.
Now we turn to the former Secretary of Education, Margaret Spelling. She served under President George W. Bush. She's now the founder and leader of Margaret Spellings and Company. That's a consulting firm in the Washington, D.C. area. Madam Secretary, welcome to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Michelle. I'm sorry I'm not seeing you face to face.
I know, we'll have to rectify that. So now that you're out of office, a little out of the pressure cooker, what can you tell us now that you couldn't say then?
Well, you know, and I've just heard Arne Duncan say some of the things that I used to say in more nuanced ways than I would say them now. And to pick up on his very last point, for example, on the opportunity gap, what he is saying is we need to get serious about how we allocate resources. Sometimes I say if you have a PhD and loads of experience, you are at Cream Puff High teaching AP, one of 25 AP classes offered in suburbia, et cetera. And if you're in the inner city, then you have, you know, very meager offerings, some of our brand new, most challenged teachers sent to do the hardest work, and then we're surprised at the results. So I think what the Secretary and I agree on is we got to really get serious about closing this achievement gap, and that includes putting our money and our resources and our best teachers where our mouths are.
You know, there's a recent survey from the Gallup polling organization about No Child Left Behind, which was the signature education initiative of the George W. Bush administration. You know, 67% of parents of school-aged children said that the policy made no difference or made American schools worse. How do you respond to that, and why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I look at polls just like the one that was conducted around Education Nation, a couple of weeks ago, and they found that 88% of parents, and particularly minority parents, support testing and accountability. They know that it is their children that have been left behind, that have been swept through the system. And so, you know, can we find dueling polls about how parents feel about these things? I know for sure that if we don't measure and find out who is left behind, they will not be served adequately, and we will continue to bury the problem, and it'll be a, you know, kind of a silent killer.
It's interesting, though, that same poll shows, the Gallup poll that I cited, says that adults in lower-income households, those earning less than $30,000 a year, are far more likely to than those in higher-income households to believe that the law has made public education better. And I'm wondering why you think that is.
That's right, because, you know, No Child Left Behind spoke to those particular children. And it is this allocation of resources and focus and attention. I mean, it's not a mystery that schools have focused on, you know, cut scores and, you know, attended to the needs of poor and minority and special ed kids as never before, because that's what got measured. I am a big what gets measured gets done kind of gal. And that clearly was the focal point of the law, and it had never been before. We had a lot of happy talk and very little reality around those goals.
But people like yourself, and you just heard Secretary of Education Arne Duncan again talk about the, let's call it, the resources gap. I mean, the fact is that most local schools are generally funded locally, and there's a big difference in the kinds of resources that are available.
And here's why. What's the answer? Here's
why.
We largely, especially in our urban centers, have teacher union contracts that allow the teachers to choose where they work. And so where do you want to work, you know, if you're an experienced teacher? Do you want to, you know, work in your own neighborhood and drive across town to kids who are very advantaged and off on spring break and this and that? Or do you want to go into our inner cities and work with the most challenged kids and families in our system? And so that's why we end up with these results that we have. We have teachers deciding where they get to place themselves.
But isn't that most people? I mean, don't most professionals decide where they work? I mean, do you think then the teaching profession should be like the military, where that once you sign up, you go wherever you're told? Is that how you think it should
work? No, I don't think that most people who are employed get to decide, you know, when and where they apply their profession. In fact, I think just the opposite. We pay and reward people in the private sector to do the most challenging work. We pay them more to do it.
Finally, what would you like to have accomplished that you didn't? And what would you most like to see, whoever has the post in the next 4 years?
Here's
most. What would you like them to focus on most?
What I am so, so worried about in these waivers that Secretary Duncan has just granted, and I'm the first person to say No Child Left Behind needs to be updated. It's been, you know, way overdue by the Congress. But I am heartsick that we are walking away from these high expectations for all of our kids. When I see Virginia, my home state, get a waiver that allows the state to serve 59% of the African-American kids and 79% of the Asian kids, that is what President Bush used to call the soft bigotry of low expectations. And what I see us doing in order to make adults comfortable is to kind of give up on and sort of admit defeat.
Okay. All right, Margaret Spelling. She served as U.S. Secretary of Education under George W. Bush. I hope the conversation will continue and you'll join us once again from our studios in Washington, D.C. or wherever you happen to be. Madam Secretary, thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks, Michelle.
Let's go now to Sarah Gonzalez. She's a reporter for State Impact Florida and following the education conversation on Twitter at #NPREdChat. Sarah, what do you have for us?
Hey, Michelle. So Arnie Duncan mentioned third grade test scores, and we got a tweet from Reading by Third, which I imagine is Reading by Third Grade, who says, schools can't do this alone. Communities need to work with them to help students learn to read well by the end of third grade. And other folks on Twitter are also agreeing with Duncan and Spelling, tweeting about the importance of retaining and attracting good teachers in low-income schools.
Okay, that's interesting. Sarah Gonzalez, please keep following things for us. She's a reporter for State Impact Florida, and we'll be checking in with her throughout the program for more of your tweets. Thanks, Sarah. On Twitter, Education Forum continues in a moment with Michelle Rhee, a reform advocate, the former chancellor of Washington, D.C.'s public schools, and Alberto Cavallo, the superintendent of Miami-Dade County Public Schools. Please stay with us on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we will speak with a former education official who has had a change of heart about some of the school reforms she once championed. Diane Ravitch will be with us in just a few minutes. But first, we turn to two education leaders who have become major voices nationally owing to their work on the local level. Michelle Rhee is the former chancellor of Washington, D.C.'s public schools. She left that position 2 years ago and founded Students First, an advocacy organization. Michelle Rhee, glad to have you back with us once again. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Alberto Cavallo. He is the current superintendent of the Miami-Dade Public Schools. We should also mention that the Miami-Dade County School District is the licensee of WLRN Public Media, our partner in this broadcast. Welcome to you. Thank you so much
for
joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
We're glad to get the two of you together because you both have the experience of running a large urban school system. Superintendent Cavallo, Miami is the fourth largest school system in the country. What is the one thing that keeps you up at night more than any other?
The mere fact that, as Secretary Duncan said recently, that far too many young men and women drop out of school, don't get to finish high school, and they're condemned to a life of poverty, a cycle that has been so pervasive in generations before them. And that keeps me up at night. But, you know, every morning I have an opportunity to wake up and change that. And I think that's exactly what we're achieving here in Miami-Dade, and opportunities created by forcing the key issues to be addressed. Number one, high quality and effective leaders, effective teachers, innovation, and parental empowerment by providing choices that are appealing to parents and students alike.
Michelle Rhee, you've been actively participating in our education conversation on Twitter at hashtag NPR EdChat. We appreciate that. Now, you were never known for holding back when you were superintendent, but I did want to ask if there is something you can say now that you're on the outside that you could not say or did not say while you were running a school district.
Well, honestly, Michelle, you know that one of the things that I made a priority in my administration was to be very honest with people about what was working in the school district and what wasn't working in the school district. And I think to Secretary Spelling's point, that oftentimes in education, we are so concerned with making the adults sort of feel good about themselves and, you know, how can we all live in harmony, that we have been all too willing to turn a blind eye to the realities that are happening to children in our classrooms every day. So I think we really do have to have more of a focus on making sure that we can be very honest about the shortcomings of our public education system, because we're not going to be able to fix the problems until we acknowledge that they're there.
I wanted to talk to both of you about two issues that are really present in conversations around education right now. One is school choice, and the other, of course, is teacher evaluation. So let's take the choice question first. Michelle Rhee, that you closed some 23 schools in the District of Columbia, which doesn't sound like a big number, except that it's a small space. And I'd like to play a question that we received in response to one of your tweets. Here it is.
Hello, my name is Brian Bennett, and I'm a science teacher in South Bend, Indiana. Michelle retweeted, "Open enrollment policies allow some children to choose a school that is better suited to their education needs." My question is, what happens to schools that don't offer open enrollment? Overcrowding and closing schools is no way to improve.
I mean, Michelle, I think that really the broader question here is that, and the criticism is that the offering this choice doesn't have the desired effect of improving the other schools. And I'd like to ask what you say about that.
Well, I think that that's actually not true. I mean, when you close schools, it doesn't result in an overcrowding of schools. In situations like we had in Washington, D.C., we simply were operating far too many schools. We were operating schools that were half empty, and therefore we were spending a lot of money in ways that wasn't having an impact on children. So in schools where you have school districts where you have declining enrollment, you really do have to right size the district in order to have a better utilization of resources. And I think that if a school district does focus on closing down its lower performing schools, then yeah, the options that students are going to be left with are the higher performing schools.
Michelle Rhee is the former chancellor of Washington, D.C.'s public schools. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about education reform. I'm joined by her and Alberto Cavallo. He's the superintendent of Miami-Dade County Public Schools. Could you take on the question, Superintendent Cavallo, of the teacher evaluation question? It's a big issue here in a lot of school districts around the country. You implemented a policy for teacher evaluations that judges teachers based on how well their students score on standardized tests. But, you know, as we were talking about, we've been talking about throughout the program, there are those who argue that this actually discourages teachers from teaching the students who are the hardest to teach, the most disadvantaged, the most have the most needs, because they're not going to achieve the same results and they're going to be penalized for it in compensation. Could you talk about that?
Certainly. That's certainly a potential unfortunate consequence. But, you know, if you're respectful about the process and you're inclusive and you actually develop a partnership with teachers and those who represent teachers, then you can get to a better place for both teachers and students alike. It does not have to be an either-or proposition. It can be a both and win for all. And that's exactly what we did in Miami-Dade. We negotiated contracts. We negotiated the implementation of Race to the Top, for example, with performance pay for teachers, tying teacher financial incentives to student outcomes. Well, we did it in a respectful way, recognizing not only student achievement data, but also the peculiarity of the classroom and the student that the teacher teaches. Not ignoring conversations about poverty, not using it as excuse either, language or disability, putting all of that in the same table of conversation. And we were able to negotiate a teacher contract and an evaluation process that's respectful, that provides performance pay, ties student achievement data to the teacher's evaluation, but it was negotiated. It was through negotiation, not imposition. I'd like to revisit the last issue. Mm-hmm. That, too, I don't think is – we should not be embracing simplistic answers to really complex problems. And I think when we simply say, you know, the school's not performing, let's shut it down, why not try to improve it first? So I'd like to speak briefly about the Miami-Dade phenomenon. When I became superintendent, there were 19 schools that had never been anything more than an F or a D on an A through F scale, nine of which were condemned to be shut down by the state for performance. Now, I became superintendent. I decided that rather than simply shutting them down, I was going to try to improve. Now, I had to change everything. I did have to fire the nine principals. I did have to change faculties, but we did it in a responsible and respectful way. 2 years later, every one of these schools has improved dramatically. Graduation rates went up as high as 50% in some of these schools. The graduation rate in these schools are now higher than the district average and the state average. Miracles are possible if we're determined to make them happen.
Michelle Reed, you know, you want to answer that? Is this a matter of communicating respectfully?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that we have to realize is that there are schools in this country that have been failing children for generations, not where aggressive reform measures have been taking place, which is what Dr. Cavallo is talking about, but where year in and year out, people are saying, well, we just need to invest more money. We need to invest more money. We need to, you know, we need to not close these schools down. And what I would challenge people to think about is this. Let's take this into a different realm. If I took my shirts to a dry cleaner, and 7 out of every 10 shirts that I took, they failed to actually do it. There was a burn mark on them. What would we do? Well, we would stop taking our shirts to that dry cleaner. We would not say, well, you know, in order for the dry cleaner to become better, we need to keep taking our shirts there so that they can invest in better equipment and better training for their employees, et cetera. No, we wouldn't do that because we would say, these are my shirts. I don't want them to get ruined. If we take that kind of care with our laundry, then certainly we have to take equal amount of care with our children every day. We cannot afford to continue to send our children year in and year out to failing schools, hoping that through a new 5-year or 10-year plan, it'll get better, especially when so many of these schools have been failing for so long. So yes, we should absolutely invest in very aggressive and rapid turnarounds in some cases, but we just can't be in a position where in some communities we're allowing the schools to fail generation after generation.
We have to leave it there for now. This is a rich and important conversation. We hope it will continue. Michelle Rhee is the former chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools and founder of Students First. That's an advocacy organization. She was with us from Ohio Public Radio in Columbus. Alberto Cavallo is the superintendent of Miami-Dade Public Schools. He was with us here at member station WLRN in Miami. I hope you'll come back and see us again. Thank you so much for joining us. Our next guest spent years allied with key conservatives on education reform. Diane Ravitch is the former Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. During her time in that administration and afterwards, she advocated standardized testing and expanding school choice through charter schools. Those would later become key elements of No Child Left Behind under President George W. Bush, but she eventually became a critic of these approaches. She's now a professor of education at New York University and the author of a number of books, including The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. And she's with us now. Diane Ravitch, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Michelle, for inviting me.
Now, you know, it is pretty rare that people change their minds about something publicly. And I know that it's a complex topic, which is why, you've written, a book about it and many monographs. But I did want to ask, if, as briefly as you can tell us, did you have a eureka moment? Was there some specific piece of data or something that convinced you that these ideas were flawed?
When I believed that they would work, they hadn't been tried. Once they were tried, I was convinced that they didn't work. And in fact, not only were they failing, but they're ruining American education, and they're actually leading the way today towards privatization of public education, which I think would be a disaster.
Could you just expand on that a little bit? I mean, you've heard the arguments though that we've had on the program so far. I mean, the argument is that in the absence of a testing regimen, a comprehensive testing regimen, there really isn't any incentive for the schools to demonstrate that kids are learning, especially in areas where the parents aren't strong advocates for themselves for whatever reason, or for their kids for whatever reason. How do you respond to that, Michelle? That's wrong.
I was going to say it's nonsensical. Testing does not close achievement gaps. Testing just shows that there are gaps, but then you have to do something about it. Testing should be used diagnostically. It should not be used the way we're using it today. It's being used to punish teachers, to close schools, and to do all sorts of high-stake things like merit pay and basing teachers' evaluation on testing. And that's wrong. The cause of the achievement gap is poverty and segregation and an absence of resources. Wherever you find that toxic combination of high poverty and racial segregation, you will find low test scores. And so what's happening today is that we first, we have No Child Left Behind, which I believe is a failed policy. I mean, Secretary Duncan said it's broken. It's broken and it's failed. We have many, many children left behind. They're the same children who were left behind when the law was passed over 10 years ago. But No Child Left Behind set an unreasonable goal. It said 100% of the children would be proficient. And then when the 100% are not proficient, it's unreasonable because no nation in the world has 100% of the children proficient. We label those schools failing schools. We fire the teachers, we close the schools, and then they're set up for privatization. So I think this is a terrible process that has been set into motion that is doing tremendous damage to public education.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about the recent Chicago teacher strike, which they recently ended a 7-day strike. They signed a new contract with pay raises. You know, that the whole issue, you know, of teacher contracts seems to become a polarizing issue, where on the one hand, people will say, well, of course, you know, this is a difficult and important job, and of course teachers should be compensated as well as possible. Others look at a circumstance like that and say, this is an example of where the education systems are set up for the benefit of the adults, not for the kids. How do you read what just happened in Chicago?
Well, first of all, compensation was not the issue. That had been settled before the strike. A longer school day was not the issue. That had been settled before the strike. The strike was really about getting better resources, more resources for the kids who needed them. There are 160 schools in Chicago that don't have a school library. There are almost half the schools that don't have an arts teacher. There are overcrowded classrooms. And the teaching conditions and the learning conditions are the same for the children, and they're very poor. And what the teachers were striking about was they have been reformed now for almost 20 years. Arne Duncan was the superintendent of schools there, and he said there would be a renaissance by 2010. What we know from Chicago is that opening charter schools doesn't improve education. Chicago has many charter schools, as New York does, as Washington, D.C. does, and we have not seen any difference between the charter schools and the regular public schools. So the idea is if you can just break the union, turn it over to private management, you'll see an improvement. But what frequently happens in charters is they skim the best kids, they kick out the low-performing kids, they don't take the special ed kids, they don't take the English language learners, and it artificially inflates their test scores. But the charter schools, on the whole, on average, do not get better results than regular public schools, even though they don't have a union.
Finally, you know, you wrote an opinion piece for the Wall Street Journal in 2010, and you said something you said here again today, which is poverty is the biggest predictor of low academic performance and that government should focus on that to help students. Do you feel that there are any key players in education who have that point of view, who are working in that direction? I guess what I'm asking is, do you feel that is that a point of view that's actually widely shared, even if it's not widely articulated or not? And if not, why not?
First of all, I'd say that it's a point of view that's widely shared amongst the teachers of the United States. Millions of teachers understand it. Many superintendents and principals understand it. They know that testing is not going to close gaps. It's simply going to reflect gaps. The other thing you should know, and I think it's really important in this conversation to say this, the NAEP scores, that is the federal testing scores today, are the highest they've ever been in history. You have heard today from Secretary Duncan and from Michelle Rhee and from former Secretary Spellings what I consider to be the false reform narrative. It's not about reform. It's about bashing American education. The scores for white students, black students, Hispanic students, and Asian students are the highest they've ever been since federal testing began 40 years ago. We also have the highest high school graduation rate in history for the people in the age group 18 to 24. We also have the lowest dropout rate in history for that age group, 18 to 24. Only 8% of them don't have a high school diploma. So what you've heard is a false narrative, and I would ask you to think twice before you allow people to say that the system is broken, the system is failing. This is not true. We certainly have districts like New York and Chicago and Baltimore, and wherever there is this combination of high poverty and high segregation, you will find low test scores. What you'll also find is dedicated teachers.
Well, thank you for your perspective on this. This is why we invited a range of views to participate in our conversation so we can get the benefit of all of them. Diane Ravitch is an education historian and the author of, most recently, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. She was with us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Diane Ravitch, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now we turn once again to Sarah Gonzalez, a reporter for State Impact Florida. She's following the education conversation on Twitter at hashtag NPR EdChat. Sarah, what do you have for us now?
Okay, so folks are still talking about equitable school funding for all. Ravitch mentioned how testing isn't going to close the achievement gap, but highlight it. And C. Durkin Robinson tweeted out, who wants to put their kids in failing schools with the hope that they'll improve? School counselor also said, all our students, regardless of socioeconomic status, deserve outstanding educators.
Sarah Gonzalez is a reporter for State Impact Florida. We'll be checking back in with her once again during our broadcast to hear more tweets. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
After a short break, our Twitter education forum will continue with Salman Khan. He is the founder of the popular online teaching tool, the Khan Academy. Please stay with us on Tell Me More from NPR News, our special broadcast from WLRN in Miami. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We are continuing Tell Me More's first Twitter education forum. Join in on Twitter at hashtag NPR EdChat. Coming up, we'll hear the voices of people you could argue have the most invested in America's schools, the students. But first, we turn to online education. If you or your child have ever been stumped by homework, then you probably already know about the Khan Academy. The company, led by founder Salman Khan, has created thousands of online lessons in math, science, economics, and history. They have scored nearly 200 million views by students and parents looking for a little extra help. Microsoft billionaire Bill Gates says he's even used them to help his own children master math concepts. But what Salman Khan is trying to accomplish actually goes far beyond helping the children of friends, or billionaires for that matter, finish their homework. He's arguing for a radical change in how we think about and do learning. And Salman Khan lays out these ideas in his new book, The One World Schoolhouse, and he is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Well, you know, YouTube is known more for cats playing the piano and kids falling off their bikes, right? But as we mentioned, your videos have been viewed more than 200 million times. And if you don't mind, I just want to play a short clip from one of the videos so people have a sense of what we're talking about if they're not already familiar with them.
If I had two magenta cherries and I wanted to add to it three blueberries, how many total pieces of fruit do I now have? And you say, oh, one, two, three, four, five.
Now, you're not an educator by training. You were actually working in finance when you started the Khan Academy. I'm just wondering, when you look back on it now, what do you think it is that you tapped into that's made these so appealing?
I think there's a bunch of dimensions. I think, first of all, you know, there's a lot of students at all levels, at all ages, who have kind of gaps in their learning. And when they're in a large classroom or a classroom of any size, they're embarrassed or they're afraid to raise their hand. I saw that with my cousins when I started tutoring them. And if you're in algebra, it's very hard to raise your hand and say, wait, I'm a little shaky on fractions. I'm a little shaky on decimals. And at the same time, I think they're looking for something that is it's bite-sized but still comprehensive, focuses on intuition, and is also conversational. And you heard that little piece just now. I made the first ones for my cousins, and even now I kind of imagine that I'm making them for a larger collection of cousins.
You know, you make the point over and over again that the traditional classroom models don't work, that they don't allow kids to catch up when they miss something. They don't account for the way the brain really works, right? And you say, for example, that the time allotted to learn something's fixed while the comprehension is variable. And that's partly what you do.
Right. You know, we just presume this whole conversation that we've been having in education this morning, it just presumes a system, and the system is actually a human artifact. We literally got it from the Prussians 200 years ago, and it's inspired by the Industrial Revolution. Group kids together in batches and push them together at a set pace and kind of apply information to them, and at the end of it, you kind of filter them out based on how much they got. And a lot of it's really set up to, or it guarantees that students will end up with these gaps. I mean, we've worked with, in a school in Oakland, we've seen, it was an algebra class, and they had a great teacher, and the students were trying their best. But we saw in the data when they were using our tools that a good number of them didn't know their multiplication tables. A good number of them didn't know negative numbers. And it's not surprising, because a lot of them, when they were in pre-algebra or when they were in arithmetic, they got a C on an exam, maybe on multiplication, maybe on negative numbers. And despite that, or they might have even failed an exam, they were promoted to the next grade. And then all of a sudden you're in algebra. There's no way to really address those gaps. And then when they fail, even despite having an excellent teacher, people say, oh, we need to test it more. We need to do this more. But the reality is, no, we should have just let them remediate, build their foundations. We should have never let them get to algebra without having at least a solid foundation. So instead of making variable how well you learn something, which is what we consider our grades, and making that some type of a judgment on your intelligence, and what's fixed is when you learn something, we should do it the other way around. The variable should be learn at your own pace. The variable is when you learn it, and what's fixed is that you have a very solid foundation.
If you just joined us, you're tuning into our Twitter Education Forum. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm speaking with Salman Khan, founder of the Khan Academy, a popular online teaching tool, and he's just written a new book about his ideas. I'm getting a tweet from Nancy Evans in Philadelphia, and she says, how do you help students with limited access to computers? This goes back to equity and the achievement gap.
Yeah, I think it's a huge issue in some of the underserved areas that we've been working with schools. They've been setting up computer labs, extended hours on the computer labs. It's definitely not a solved problem right now. You know, the good thing and the reason to be optimistic about it is the technology is getting dramatically cheaper every day in the developed world. In our world, it's getting more and more common and ubiquitous. And in the developing world, it's also getting a lot cheaper. But I won't claim that it's a solved problem. But hopefully over the next 4 or 5 years, as you know, you'll see sub-$100 devices, broadband will get dramatically cheaper. We'll be able to address that.
And one of the other criticisms of Khan Academy and other online learning tools, to be fair, is what's the quality control? You know, teachers in brick and mortar schools have to be certified, and there's all the scrutiny attached to their results. We've been talking a lot about that in the course of this hour, the teacher evaluations and so forth. You know, you're not regulated, and online companies like yours aren't regulated. How are you held accountable? How are companies like yours held accountable if the lessons confuse students or don't give them what they need?
Right, right. No, it's an important issue. And you know, we're not a company in the traditional sense. We're a not-for-profit, but it's still an important issue. If a lot of people are using us, we got to make sure that it's quality material and it's definitely impacting things. On our side, we're working with a lot of people, to educators, ed researchers. We have a few people in-house, a postdoc at Stanford, who's looking at the learning side. We get a ton of data. That's what I think a lot of the foundations are excited about, is that we can start to do learning analytics at a scale that people haven't seen before. On top of that, we have third-party evaluations going on with many of
the schools. We have 20,000 schools using us in some way, shape, or form. The ones we're working closely with, we're measuring what are the impact on scores and on more subjective measures, on how teachers feel about their jobs, how do the students feel about the level of engagement. And then the next level is really something that has never existed before, which is traditionally, if there's a mistake in a classroom or even sometimes a textbook, it won't get noticed because there's not other experts looking at it. One thing about the internet is, stuff that I produce or our organization produces, it's out there for the world to scrutinize, to put feedback on. And unlike a textbook where we have to wait for the next publishing cycle to put out a revision, we can do it in a matter of minutes.
And speaking of matter of minutes, we only have a minute left, but I did want to ask you this. If we get together 5 years from now, and I hope it won't be that long, but if we do, what kind of conversation do you think we'll have about education? What kind of conversation do you hope we will be having?
I think we'll be in 5 years surprised how much things have changed. People are very cynical right now. They don't think a lot will change. But what we're seeing is adoption in schools far faster than I would have expected. And it's not, one thing I emphasize, it's not about virtual replacing physical. It's about virtual being a tool for physical so that physical is more interactive, more engaging. And so I think in 5 years, we'll be thinking about, remember when classrooms tended to be dominated by lectures and all moved at the same pace? Isn't it great that we have technology now and it's universally accessible where class time is very interactive? And we envy the kids today because they don't have to sit passively and kind of stare at a clock.
Salman Khan is the founder of the Online Khan Academy. He's author of the new book, The One World Schoolhouse, and he was kind enough to join us from the studios at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Next up on this special broadcast of our Twitter Education Forum, we remind you that we've already had conversations with policymakers, teachers, and parents. So now we want to give the final word to those who I think we all agree have the most at stake, the students. Now, we'd love to hear from the millions of American students who are part of America's public education system, but we can't, so we're hearing from two. Joining us now are Nikhil Goyal. He is a senior at Syosset High School. That's in Long Island, New York. He actually wrote a book on education reform titled One Size Does Not Fit All. Also with us is Shakira Lockett. She is a graduate of Coral Gables Senior High School in Miami, and she's currently a student at Miami-Dade College. Welcome to you both. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You got the attention of a lot of policymakers, a lot of people who really care about this subject. So, Nikhil, what is the one thing you would most want people to think about when they think about the world that you need as a student, or what the world you've just left, or the world that you are still in as a student? What do you think that students most need?
Students most need a voice because we've been shunned out of the debate. We've been left on the sidelines. I like to say in education reform, there's two different tables, the kids' table and the adults' table. And we need to combine those two together to really have a rich conversation with all the stakeholders present.
Shakira, what about you? You've got the attention now of a lot of people who care very deeply about this subject. What would you most want them to know?
I think that students need more help, more people there to support them, more hands-on training, let them know what they needed to prepare for, let them know what they need to study for. That way they won't be lost in the real world.
You graduated from high school in 2008, and I understand that you had to take 5 remedial classes once you got to college, which had to have been expensive and time-consuming. Why do you think that is? Why did that happen? And do you think your school was broken?
I think that with me, math has always been a problem. So by me going off to college and not knowing, like really prepared about what's going to happen, everything became a total mess. I didn't understand anything. And supposed to be on the test that I had to take to get into college, it was elementary math. And I don't think it was elementary at all. Nothing I learned in high school, middle school, nothing prepared me for that test.
Now, do you think that you got poor counseling or do you think you got poor instruction? What do you think is at the core of what happened to you?
Sometimes I believe that was me, but maybe if it would have been more hands-on, one-on-one, maybe I would have understood it more.
Hmm. And what was the consequence of your having to take all those remedial classes? I mean, what did it say?
I had to end up staying in college longer than I was supposed to, and it cost me more. I have had to write letters to the financial aid advisors to help me to pay for the course because by me taking it over and over, it became more expensive.
So you had to pay to learn what you should have learned for free in high school.
Yes, ma'am.
Or at least what your parents had paid for through their taxes.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, Nick Hill, in your book, you write that we need to stop making reforms, which is a word we hear a lot, and that we need a revolution. What do you mean by that?
I think we really need to start from scratch in the sense that the system really needs to be rebooted. We need to question every assumption by which it was based on. We have to get out of this industrial mindset where the education system really started in the 1800s and 1900s.
Well, tell me a little bit more. What would an excellent education system look like? Or what would an educational system that you think prepares students for the world now look like?
Yeah, an education system would include letting kids become the captains of their learning. So giving them some control, letting them shape and mold their education in many ways, letting them do projects and hands-on activities, and really bridging the gap between what goes on in the classroom and the real world.
Shakira, what about you? What do you think an excellent educational system would look like?
I don't know if it's okay to quote Mr. Romney, but he said he thinks that education would be improved by having more teachers.
Didn't President Obama say the same thing?
Yes, yes.
Shakira, can I ask you this? You didn't find out that you were not college ready until you got to college.
Yes, ma'am. The day I took the test, I didn't know.
Why do you think you didn't find out until you already got there? I mean, shouldn't there have been some signs along the way? You know, your SATs?
Yes, I think there should have been some signs,
like
some preparations, something to let me know that, okay, this test will be here and you need to study for this. It was no warning or anything. It was just a test when I went that day and that was it.
How do you feel now when you think back on your education? How do you feel about it? And how do you feel about the people who were in charge? I mean, do you feel like they did the best they could? Or do you feel angry? How do you feel?
I do feel angry about the cost and how it takes longer for you to graduate because you don't even know that the remedial classes doesn't count for your major. It's like you're going to school for no reason all over again.
Nikhil, what is the one thing you would most want people to think about when you think about all the educators, teachers, administrators that you've interacted with over the course of your educational career to this point? How do you feel about them?
I think a lot of them are really stuck in the old mindset. There have been a few teachers, for example, my teacher, Thomas Barella. He actually even wasn't my teacher in a formal class. We found each other through a club. And he's inspired me. We basically have conversations almost every day on politics and current affairs. And I want every kid to have a teacher like him in the sense that they continuously push them over and over again.
And what are your plans now?
So I'm going to be graduating from high school in January. And from there, I plan on taking about a year and a half off doing various projects and starting my organization, Learning Revolution, to bring some of the ideas in my book to life.
Wow. Shakira, what about you? What are your plans now?
My plans now, I'm going to graduate this semester.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you so much. Hopefully to go off maybe to FAU or UCF to further my degree in mass communications. And hopefully I'll be the next Oprah Winfrey.
Okay. All right. Oh, good. Well, you can employ us, too. Great.
Yes.
Keep a spot open for us. Shakira Lockett is a student at Miami-Dade College. She's a graduate of Coral Gables Senior High in Miami. She was kind enough to join us from member station WLRN in Miami. Nick Hill Goyle is a senior at Syosset High School. That's in Long Island, New York. And he was kind enough to join us from our NPR studios in New York. Thank you both so much for joining us. Congratulations to you both on all you've accomplished so far. You made it sort of close.
Thanks for allowing us to join you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as we conclude the special Twitter Education Forum today, we are going to take our broadcast one more time back to our tweet-up room with Sarah Gonzalez. She's a State Impact Florida reporter who's following our live forum on Twitter. So, Sarah, overall, how has our Twitter audience answered the question, are American schools broken?
Well, first, let me just say that our tweets, as they say, are being very active on the Twitter conversation. We're getting multiple tweets every second, comments about technology and access to technology, the achievement gap, and, of course, test scores, which has been a big thread from the beginning of the conversation. Mrs. L135 said, are there bad schools? Sure. Can those schools be identified from one test score? No. And as we heard, Nick Hill talked about students having a voice in the education reform conversation, and that's been getting has started a lot of conversations. Dr. Stevens Jones commented, adults need to start listening to the students and implement the changes. Father Gator asked, are students the customers or the product?
Interesting. But for what can you can tell overall, what's the tone of the responses that we're getting? Are people hopeful? Do they feel pessimistic, optimistic about what's out there, what they're experiencing in their schools and the schools that they know?
I think it's a pretty good mix of both sides. People are focusing a lot on funding and the achievement gap and low-income schools, and they're talking about what is a solution. Is it private school vouchers and charter schools? Is it more school choice? We have people saying, no, that's not the answer. So it's been a good mix.
Sarah Gonzalez, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sarah Gonzalez is a reporter for State Impact Florida, and she was with us here at Member Station WLRN in Miami. Thanks again, Sarah, and everybody on our team. And that's our program for today. We'd like to thank all of our guests who joined us in studio and on the radio, and everybody who took part in the conversation on Twitter. Also, special thanks to our partners in Miami, State Impact Florida, and Member Station WLRN. And remember that on Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. Use hashtag NPR EdChat on Twitter to tell us more about the education issues that matter to you. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more from Washington tomorrow.